Real quick, we have to take a break to acknowledge the sponsor of today's episode, which is Secret Nature. Secret Nature's ultra premium CBD gummies are crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to fit right into your day with clean, purposeful functionality. So for me personally, I like to take one of their snoozer gummies in the evening to unwind and ensure that I get a good night's sleep. After a long day, especially when my brain is just still running a mile a minute and I can't seem to settle down, I'll take one to help me slow down, unplug, and actually get a good night's sleep. I personally don't drink alcohol because I just don't like the way it makes me feel the next day, but these gummies feel very clean, intentional, and it never leaves me groggy the next morning, just feeling balanced and rested. Secret Nature's gummies are organic and farm grown. They're never lab made. They're ultra premium CBD gummies made with real botanicals and nothing extra. You've got two purpose built options. There's Bliss for clear focus and productive flow if you want to take one during the day, and then you get Snoozers to help you relax and rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's never any guessing, just clean, reliable functionality that fits naturally into your schedule. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code MAMA. That's M-A-M-A. And just a heads up, their Black Friday sale is coming up, and they are going to be offering 25% off on orders of $75 or more, 35% off on orders of $125 or more, and then 40% off on orders of $150 or more between November 26th and the 30th. So don't forget to use my code MAMA when you check out. That's M-A-M-A at secretnature.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy to see if you could save when you bundle your home and auto policies. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon's Blink Video Doorbell. Get more at your door with the easy-to-install Blink Video Doorbell. Get more connections.
Hey, I'm here for our first date.
More deliveries.
Hi, I have tacos for two.
Oh, thanks. We'll be right down. And more memories.
Babe, come down. I have a surprise.
All new Blink Video Doorbell with 2-year battery, head-to-toe HD view, and simple setup. Shop now at amazon.com/blink for just $69.99.
When life brings the blah, add more Yabba Dabba Doo with some tasty fruity pebbles. Early morning meeting, blah. Someone brought the pebbles? Yabba Dabba Doo. Run errands, blah. Head to the store for pebbles. Yabba Dabba Doo. Fruity Pebbles, less blah, more Yabba Dabba Doo. Pick up Pebbles cereal today. Yabba Dabba Doo and the Flintstones and all related characters and elements. Copyright and trademark Hanna-Barbera.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly.
And I am your co-host, Austin.
And before we dive into today's episode, we have a listener write-in that I'm going to read to you. If you would like to write into us, you can go to mamamystery.com, scroll down, there's a white box, and you can send us a message. And that is exactly what this person did. So I'm going to read it to you now. You ready?
Yep.
I look forward to your podcast more than any other. You articulate these true crime cases so well, and I absolutely love hearing how passionate you are over something you believe in. Also, the dynamic between you and Austin is so fun to listen to. I know social media can hide reality, but it seems like you really are each other's number one fan.
Oh, hell yes.
And you both care so deeply for one another. I hope the new baby and life with the bigger family is treating you well. P.S. I'm dying for you to cover OJ already, in all caps.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for that amazing message. It made my day. I wish I knew who sent it, but they didn't put their name. So whoever did, know that I really, really appreciate it. And this one is for you.
I'm excited for this one. This is the case of, at the time, one of the greatest running backs in NFL history and the trial of the century, OJ Simpson.
Today, we're diving into one of the most infamous and polarizing cases in modern history, the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman, and the subsequent trial of O.J. Simpson.
Now, this case captivated the nation, exposing deep-seated issues of race, celebrity, and justice. So we'll explore the backgrounds of OJ, Nicole, and Ron, walk through the events of that fateful night, and in part two, we're going to delve into the trial that became known as the Trial of the Century. So buckle up, because this story is a roller coaster of emotions, evidence, and intrigue.
Do you talk about his career, his playing career much?
I think I do. You know what's funny? I actually wrote this before we had Ellie. So I've had this in my pocket for like 4 months.
Can I say a few of his NFL and college collegiate accomplishments?
I did touch on it because... So I'll just go ahead and start, and then you can chime in when I talk about the football stuff. If I leave anything out, you let me know, okay?
Okay.
Okay. So Orenthal James, or O.J. Simpson, often known as the Juice, was born on July 9th, 1947 in San Francisco, California. Growing up in the Potrero Hill, I hope I said that right, neighborhood, O.J. had a turbulent childhood. His father, Jimmy Lee Simpson, left the family when O.J. was young, and his mother, Eunice, worked multiple jobs to support her children. And despite his early struggles, OJ found solace and success in sports, particularly football. His talent on the football field earned him a scholarship to the University of Southern California, where he became a star running back. In 1968, he won the Heisman Trophy, awarded to the best player in college football.
Massive accomplishment.
Yeah. And that award really solidified his status as a football legend and paved the way for his professional career. So in 1969, OJ was drafted by the Buffalo Bills in the NFL.
He was drafted first overall, the first overall pick in the whole draft.
That's a pretty big deal.
That's a massive deal again. Goes to show his achievement in college football and a dominant force. And then I'm not trying to get ahead of us, mm-hmm. but then this is crazy. In 1973, he became the first running back ever, the first NFL player ever to rush for over 2,000 yards in a single season. So he rushed for 2,003 yards in 73 and was the MVP. Just a dominant collegiate and first 5 years of his NFL career. And I don't really know a whole lot about O.J. Simpson. I know about his career in terms of he was a Heisman winner. He was a number one overall pick. He was the first guy to rush for 2,000 yards and got MVP. And I know he's in the freaking Hall of Fame. And all of that happened before anything to do with his trial, mm-hmm. to my knowledge.
Yes.
And so I'm excited to learn, but it's just insane to me that such a dominant athlete went this route.
Who would you compare him to in today's time? Like, I know there's a lot of people out there who already know about OJ, but I'm not really into football all that much. So like, if you could compare him to a player that's relevant today, who would it be?
Well, let me throw you a curveball. Not in terms of achievement, I would compare him to Aaron Hernandez.
Really?
Just in terms of being a psycho.
Oh, you're saying not in terms of
necessarily achievement, yeah, on the field.
Aaron Hernandez is going to be a separate episode.
Oh, man, you should watch the Mind of Aaron Hernandez documentary on Netflix. It's wild. So in terms of his craziness and the personality and this athlete doing this type of thing, yeah, Aaron Hernandez. In terms of, I mean, like, you know, Jamal Lewis was a huge running back that rushed for over 2,000 yards this season, I believe, and was dominant for a short period of time. I don't think he had like a Hall of Fame career. I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing if I was alive in 1970s, in the early 70s, to see him play, I would say he was as big a deal as any guy that's the face of the league right now. Mm-hmm. You have Patrick Mahomes. He's the face of the NFL right now. I'm sure O.J. Simpson was almost the face of the league at the time. Joe Namath. I mean, you had these guys that... He was one of the most dominant players in the whole league. That's nuts.
Yeah. So he's a big deal. All right. So OJ retired from football in 1979 and was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 1985, which is a huge honor, obviously. Post-football, OJ transitioned to acting, appearing in movies such as the Naked Gun series and various television shows. His charismatic personality made him a popular figure in the entertainment industry. He was a frequent guest on talk shows and became a familiar face in commercials, further enhancing his public image. This reminds me, off the top of my head, do you remember, obviously, last week we talked about the Menendez brothers?
Yes.
So their dad worked with OJ. Like, so Jose Menendez somehow worked with OJ when it came to his involvement with the Hertz rental car company. So anyway, it's just interesting that these all kind of tied together, but I guess Jose and OJ kind of knew each other. Anyway. So O.J. Simpson met Marguerite Whitley in the mid-60s while they were both attending Galileo High School in San Francisco. At that time, their relationship blossomed quickly. They got married on June 24th of 1967. At that time, OJ was still a student at the University of Southern California, and he was still making a name for himself in college football. But the couple had three children together: Arnell Simpson, who was born in 68, Jason Simpson, who was born in 70, and then Aaron Simpson, who was born in 77. Now, during their marriage, OJ's football career took off, leading to the immense fame and wealth, and Marguerite was by his side through it all, through his rise to stardom, managing the challenges of raising a family while OJ pursued this very demanding career. In August of 1979, the Simpson family faced a devastating tragedy. Their youngest daughter, Erin, drowned in the family swimming pool shortly before her second birthday. Now, this heartbreaking event deeply affected the family, and it marked a significant strain on OJ and Marguerite's marriage. Their marriage began to deteriorate, leading to their separation in 1979 and eventual divorce in March of 79. Despite the end of their marriage, Marguerite was largely, or has largely, stayed out of the public eye, maintaining a low profile in the years following their divorce. Now, prior to the finalization of their divorce, OJ met Nicole Brown Simpson while she was working as a waitress. So Nicole Brown Simpson was born on May 19th, 1959 in Frankfurt, Germany. Her parents, Juditha and Louis Brown, were an American family living abroad due to Louis's career in the military. Nicole was the second of four children, with an older sister, Denise, and two younger siblings, Dominique and Tanya. When Nicole was a toddler, her family moved back to the United States, settling in Southern California. They lived in Garden Grove, Orange County, where Nicole spent much of her childhood. The Brown family was close-knit and valued their time together. Louis eventually transitioned from his military career to work in real estate, which provided the family with a stable and comfortable life. Nicole attended Dana Hills High School in Dana Point, California. She was known for her striking beauty, vivacious personality, and her very friendly nature. Nicole was popular among her classmates and participated in various school activities, especially photography. After graduating from high school, Nicole pursued work that allowed her to enjoy the vibrant social scene of Southern California. She worked as a waitress at the Daisy, a Beverly Hills nightclub, where she mingled with celebrities and the elite of LA. It was during her time at the Daisy that she met O.J. Simpson, who was a regular patron of the club. Nicole was just 18 years old when they started dating, while O.J. was still married to his first wife, Marguerite. Now, Nicole and O.J.'s relationship quickly became serious despite their significant age difference and O.J.'s marital status at the time. O.J. divorced Marguerite 2 years later in 79, and he and Nicole continued their relationship, eventually marrying on February 2nd of 1985. By then, Nicole was 25 years old, and O.J. was 37. Now, Nicole's life with O.J. Simpson was as glamorous as it was turbulent. The couple lived in a luxurious estate in Brentwood, a wealthy neighborhood in L.A. They had two children together, Sydney, who was born in 85, and Justin, who was born in 88. But Nicole confided in friends that OJ often called her a fat pig while she was pregnant.
Good Lord.
Yeah. Nicole was deeply devoted to her children, often seen doting on them and ensuring that they had a happy and loving home. She was very hands-on with her kids. She attended every school function, every sporting event. She organized elaborate birthday parties for them and truly made their happiness her priority. And I think she made a great effort to make sure her kids weren't as aware of the abuse as they essentially could have been, probably. Like, I have to wonder if the kids maybe heard some things, but she just tried to hide it as best she could. But one of the most significant and documented instances of abuse occurred on New Year's Day of 1989. Now, this incident not only highlighted the severity of the abuse that Nicole endured, but also brought to light the lengths that she went to protect her children from witnessing the violence. On January 1st, 1989, tensions between Nicole and OJ escalated into a violent assault. The couple had been arguing, and the situation quickly spiraled out of control. OJ became physically aggressive, attacking Nicole in their Brentwood home. So Nicole called 911, and here is a clip of that audio.
911 emergency.
Can you get someone over here now to 325 Gretna Green? He's back. Please.
Okay, what does he look like?
He's O.J. Simpson. I think you know his record. Could you just send somebody over here?
Okay, what is he doing there?
He just drove up again.
He just drove
somebody
up.
Over?
Okay, wait a minute. What kind of car is he in?
He's in a white Bronco, but first of all, he broke the back door down to get in.
Okay, wait a minute. What's your name?
Nicole Simpson.
Okay, is he the sportscaster or whatever?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Wait a minute. We're sending the police. What is he doing? Is he threatening you?
I'm going nuts.
Okay, has he threatened you in any way, or is he just harassing you?
You're going to hear him in a minute. He's about to come in again.
Okay, just stay on the line.
I don't want to stay on the line. He's going to beat the shit out of
me. Wait a minute. Wait, just stay on the line so we can know what's going on until the police get there, okay? Okay, Nicole?
Uh-huh.
Just a moment. Does he have any weapons?
I don't know.
Okay.
He went home. Now he's back.
Okay.
My kids are upstairs sleeping, and I don't want anything to happen.
Okay. Has he hit you today or no?
No.
Okay. You don't need any paramedics or anything?
Uh-uh.
Okay. You just want him to leave.
My door. He broke the whole back door in.
And then he left and he came back?
And he came and he practically knocked my upstairs door down, but he pounded it. And then he screamed and hollered, and I tried to get him out of the bedroom because the kids were sleeping in there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then he wanted somebody's phone number, and I gave him my phone book and was going to, or I gave, put my phone book down to write, mm-hmm. write down the phone number that he wanted. And mm-hmm. then he took my phone book with all my stuff in it.
That's super sad. I mean, you can hear she's frightened.
Yeah. And then you can hear him just losing his shit in the background.
And like in any situation, domestic violence like that, that's frightening and terrible. Gosh, when you think of this freaking former NFL running back beast, mm-hmm. it even makes it scarier.
Yeah. Cause this is a guy who's capable of
running grown men,
pummeling over grown men.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and not just grown men, like, huge guys that work out consistently. I mean, yeah, it's a different caliber.
Just makes it even more like heavy to listen to.
Yeah, for sure. So when the police arrived at their house, they found Nicole visibly bruised and shaken. She was hiding in the bushes of her home outside, half naked. She had been brutally beaten by OJ and told officers that he had punched, slapped, and kicked her. One thing real quick, that 911 audio. I'm not 100% sure that it is from this same night, but in the event that it's not, this at least just shows you that like this was a frequent thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, any times more than just once is frequent for me, but anyway, it's just to at least show you the kind of fear that she was in.
Mm-hmm.
So she told the police that he had punched, slapped, and kicked her. The officers noted that Nicole at the time had a cut lip and bruises all over her face and her body. Despite the clear signs of physical abuse, OJ was not arrested on the spot. He was, however, taken into custody later and charged with spousal battery. So OJ pleaded no contest to the charge of spousal battery, and this plea meant that he did not admit guilt but accepted the conviction without contesting the evidence. And as a result, he was sentenced to probation, community service, and mandatory counseling. Despite the legal repercussions, OJ managed to avoid jail time, and the incident was one of many that highlighted the flaws of the justice system in dealing with domestic violence and high-profile people. So in a People magazine article from 1995, the writer of the article, Shelley Levitt, suggested in part that some claimed that the Brown family was dazzled by Simpson's fame and wealth and that it had benefited them. And the article reported that OJ once secured a Hertz dealership for Nicole's father, Lewis, and paid for his then-wife's two younger sisters' college tuitions. But the Brown family's lawyer at the time, Gloria Allred, denied that the perks of being affiliated with OJ affected how the family treated the marriage. And she actually said, if anyone thinks that a member of the Brown family would rather have a trip to a football game instead of Nicole sitting at dinner, they're mistaken. And she was quoted in the People article, no gift can be a license to kill. Because at the time, a lot of people were suggesting that the Brown family was kind of overlooking the abuse that Nicole was going through because they wanted her to keep getting those benefits. Now, following the New Year's Eve incident, Nicole tried to find ways to protect herself and her children. She sought support from friends and family and made efforts to document the abuse that she was suffering. And this documentation would later become crucial in her attempts to gain legal protection and custody of her children. Nicole filed for divorce on February 25th of 1992. Following the divorce, they remained in each other's lives for their children, of course, but they also attempted to reconcile at one point. Many friends of the couple have revealed that the couple was just infatuated with each other, and they had this like passionate obsession with each other. When things were good, they were great, but when they were bad, they were horrific.
This is so common.
Yes.
To have these like extremely high highs, extremely low lows, and continue to try to make a relationship work and mask everything.
Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, they just couldn't cut the tie that bound them. Neither of them could. Nicole even confided in a friend that she knew OJ would kill her if she ever moved on. And OJ's friends recalled how OJ would call them at ridiculous times of the night, like 4 or 5 a.m., to rant about Nicole and what she was up to. And as red as those flags were, OJ was not one to be messed with or talked off the ledge. And his friends were either afraid of him or admired him too greatly to risk not sugarcoating the way that they handled his behavior. But deep down, those who knew OJ and Nicole as a couple knew that their relationship was incredibly toxic. And that's really sad when you think about it, that all these people kind of knew what was going on. Like the people who really knew Nicole and OJ knew that this was happening, but everyone was too afraid to actually hold him accountable. In another incident on October 25th of 1993, Nicole called 911 twice in one night after OJ broke into Nicole's house in a violent rage. I think this might actually be what that 911 call was from, but it just doesn't say. I can't find like the title, like, you know what I mean?
So the date and everything, but regardless, I get the point.
Yeah. Now at the time, Nicole was staying at her rental house in Gretna Green Way in Brentwood, and they'd been divorced for about a year, but for the past 6 months, they were trying to kind of date each other again. However, on this night, OJ found a picture of Nicole and an ex-boyfriend, and he flew into a rage, breaking through the French doors at the back of her house. And while she was talking to the dispatcher, OJ was heard in the background screaming at Nicole. And, you know, eventually, Nicole recorded at least 62 incidents of assaults from OJ Simpson. And yet only 8 of those times she called the police, and only 1 of those times was OJ ever arrested.
Oh my, that's a big disparity.
Yeah.
It's crazy. 2 thoughts. Number one, the guy, the level of insecurity, all this achievement, yet you see a picture of her with her ex and you throw a fit. Obviously there's context missing, but I'm sure it was there. Number two, let's just be real. The guy had CTE.
Oh, for sure.
Every freaking football player out there does. I mean, I saw a wild statistic recently that NFL players, if there was like 10,000 players surveyed and like 90-some percent of them had CTE. Mm-hmm. And then there was this huge survey done on college football players. And if you were a college football player, it's like 80% of them have it. And then high school football players, something like 40% have it.
What?
Some sign of it. It's a bonkers statistic.
Okay, if you don't know what CTE is, I believe it stands for chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is like chronic or repeated concussions almost, like consistent and repeated
head
hits
trauma
to your head. Yeah. Which obviously you see in football, but it affects that frontal lobe, which is in the front of your brain. Okay. Now this is like from the top of my head, but I want to say it like affects your emotional reasoning, like your ability to reason rationally.
Yeah. CTE is a progressive brain condition caused by repeated head injuries, often seen in athletes like football players. It is linked to memory loss, mood changes, cognitive decline, behavioral problems, all worsening over time.
Yeah. Makes sense.
And when you think about like high school football players have, it's very scary.
Yeah, it's very scary.
And I don't think that was really a thing that was discussed back then. But like in hindsight, 50 years now, we can all say, yeah, the dude for sure had CTE.
Yeah. I wonder if after he died, if they ever did an autopsy to determine if he actually did have it. Like, I know we can assume, but I think you can only really diagnose after someone has passed to do scans on their brain. But I don't know. I don't know.
It's interesting. Yeah. I just looked it up. He was never officially diagnosed with it. Mm-hmm. For sure.
But you have to wonder. Now, before we get into the events of June 12th of 1994, I want to introduce a few key figures to this story. So you'll hear about a guy named Cato Kalin. Now, Cato Kalin is originally from Milwaukee, and he moved to LA with hopes of someday becoming an actor. He met Nicole Brown Simpson in the early 90s through mutual friends, and once they became friends, Nicole offered him a place to stay in her guest house. So he became friends with OJ as well, and after OJ and Nicole split, OJ kept the home in Brentwood and allowed Cato to continue staying in that guest house. So this will all be relevant when we talk about the facts of the story, okay? Now you'll also hear about Ron Goldman, who was the other victim in this case. Ron Lyle Goldman was born on July 2nd, 1968, to parents Sharon and Frederick. When Ron was about 6 years old, his parents split up, and at first he spent most of his time with his mother, but eventually lived primarily with his father and his younger sister, Kimberly. Ron grew up in Buffalo Grove, Illinois, about an hour outside of Chicago. And after graduating from Adlai E. Stevenson High School, he enrolled at Illinois State University. But after one semester, his family chose to move to Southern California, and he went with them. Now, Ron fit right in California, naturally adopting the lifestyle of LA, becoming an avid surfer, volleyball player, tennis player, and party goer. He even appeared on a dating show called Studs. And on this show, which is just so 90s coded, there's like footage of it on YouTube if you want to go actually watch it. But on this show, two eligible guys compete for a date with three separate girls. And both guys ended up winning, essentially, by picking the girl that picked them. And on the segment, you kind of get a sense of Ron's mannerisms. He comes off as very confident, like even a little cocky. But I mean, he's maybe exaggerating a little for the show, but anyway, when he described the perfect date with the girl he chose, he said he wanted to, quote, take her to the Colorado River on a houseboat and lay on the boat naked and make love naked.
Are you going to make love with a snowsuit on?
I don't know. The girl he chose also chose him.
I like making love naked also. What the hell?
The girl he chose also chose him. So if they actually dated after the show, that remains unknown, at least to me anyway. But like on the show, they're like making out after they chose each other. Like it's kind of funny if you want to go and watch it. But despite Ron's love for a good time, he actually did not drink and he did not do drugs. He prioritized his health and his figure, sticking to a low-fat diet and religious exercise. And at his core, Ron was a very compassionate guy who volunteered a lot of his time as a camp counselor for kids with cerebral palsy. Now, when he met Nicole Brown Simpson, or Nicole Brown, in the summer of 94, he was working as a server at the Mezzaluna Trattoria in Brentwood. Man, I feel like I'm probably butchering a lot of these names. If you're screaming at me, I'm super sorry. He and Nicole just really hit it off, but they truly remained just friends. It was strictly platonic. Nicole would let Ron borrow her Ferrari, and the two would sometimes meet for coffee or dinner, but they never told anyone that they were anything more than friends. So that's really all that we should respect. Just 6 weeks after meeting Nicole, on June 12th, 1994, the events went as follows. At about 2 p.m. that day, OJ called his girlfriend at the time, Paula Barbieri. They got into a fight over the phone because Paula wanted to go to OJ's daughter's dance recital later that day, and OJ was telling her no. After they got off the phone, Paula flew to Vegas to hang out with singer Michael Bolton, and OJ made various calls to other girlfriends, at times complaining about being unhappy. At about 4 p.m., before he left for his daughter's recital, he asked Cato Kalin, the tenant of the guest house and friend of OJ and Nicole's, to set up a date for him for that upcoming Tuesday. At around 4:30 or 5, Nicole and OJ's daughter had a dance recital at the Paul Revere Middle School. Nicole's family attended the recital, and they made plans to have dinner afterward, but did not invite OJ. What?
Can I say something?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm big into sports memorabilia. Right after OJ Simpson passed away recently, there was a document that hit the auction, sports auctions, and it was a dance recital. It was that piece of paper, the dance recital, signed by OJ that day at the recital. And it was just kind of this wild thing because it was supposedly the day that he killed her.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, go ahead.
Yeah. So Nicole's family attended the recital. They made plans to have dinner afterwards, but they did not invite OJ, which upset him. And OJ also vented to Cato that night that he was pissed about the outfit that Nicole was wearing. I guess she was wearing like a form-fitting black dress, and it just really set him off.
His ex.
Yes. Like, you have you have a girlfriend, you have other women you're talking to, you're telling your guest house tenant to set you up with more dates. Like, move on. Mm-hmm. From 6:30 to 8:30, the Brown family had dinner at the Mezzaluna restaurant where Ron was working as a server. However, he was not assigned to their table. He just happened to be there working that night. Now, in the midst of the dinner, OJ called Gretchen Stockdale, a former dancer for the LA Raiders, but she didn't answer. So he left her a voicemail saying, it's OJ who is finally at a place in his life where he is like totally, totally unattached. Whatever that means. While the Browns were at dinner, Nicole's mom accidentally dropped her glasses on the ground and the family left before she realized that she had dropped them. So after they left the restaurant, they went to Ben and Jerry's for ice cream before returning to Nicole's condo on Bundy Drive in Brentwood. At about 9 p.m., Nicole receives a call from her friend, Faye Resnick. And during this call, Nicole told Faye that she told OJ, get away from us, get out of my life, you're not welcome with this family anymore. Meanwhile, at around 9:10 p.m., OJ and Cato take OJ's Bentley to a nearby McDonald's to grab some food. Cato paid for the food, and OJ ate on their way back home. At 9:30, Ron Goldman ends his shift at the Mezzaluna restaurant and sits at the bar to unwind and drink a bottle of water. While he's there, the restaurant gets a call from Nicole's mom explaining that she believed she left her glasses. So one of the restaurant workers puts her glasses in a white envelope, and Ron offered to take them to Nicole's that evening. At 10:10 p.m., Cato calls his friend Rachel Ferrara from the guest house, proving he was home at that point. At 10:15, Nicole's neighbors heard a dog barking, and it is at this point that prosecutors believed Nicole was being attacked. At 10:22 p.m., Alan Park arrived at OJ's house in a limousine to take OJ to the airport because he was scheduled to take a flight to Chicago. Now, he waited for OJ, but he didn't come out, so he pulled up to OJ's house at about 10:40 and rang the buzzer 3 or 4 times, still with no answer. So then he called his boss to say, hey, no one's answering at OJ's house. Between 10:40 and 10:45, Cato was still on the phone with his friend Rachel when he heard thumps on the wall near the air conditioner outside. So he goes outside to investigate, and at the same time, the limousine driver is ringing OJ's buzzer and still getting no answer. Shortly before 11 p.m., the limo driver sees a black man, about 6 feet tall, 200 pounds, walking across the driveway towards the house. Finally, just after 11 p.m., OJ answers the buzzer and apologizes, saying he overslept and just got out of the shower.
Sketchy.
OJ puts his bags in the limo and heads to the airport, boarding the flight to Chicago. At 12:10 a.m., one of Nicole's neighbors, Stephen Schwab, was out walking his dog when he came upon Nicole's dog. Now, Nicole's dog was an Akita named Cato, not to be mistaken with Cato Kalin, but this dog was visibly agitated and had blood all over his paws. So they led the dog back to Nicole's, and as soon as they got there, they discovered the grisly scene at Nicole's townhome at 875 South Bundy Drive and called the police. When police arrived, they found Nicole in her black cocktail dress lying on her side in the fetal position just in front of the steps to the gated entrance of her home. And nearby, the body of Ron Goldman was found crumpled up in the corner of the gate. Near Ron's body, police found a watchman's cap, a white envelope that contained the glasses left behind by Nicole's mom, and a single brown leather glove belonging to a left hand. Bloody footprints created a trail to the rear gate, which was also marked by blood, that opened up to a back alley where detectives surmised that the killer parked his getaway car. So when detectives entered Nicole's home, they found no evidence of a disturbance, no evidence of a robbery or any altercation. The entire attack occurred outside. Her kids were asleep in their beds, candles were lit in Nicole's room, and she had just drawn a bath for herself. Police had to wake up OJ and Nicole's kids, who were only 5 and 8 at the time, and take them to the LA police station as they tried to get a hold of their dad. Detectives then drove to OJ's house on Rockingham Avenue, where they found a white Ford Bronco parked at an odd angle, as if whoever parked it did so in a hurry. Now, something I want to note about OJ's property is that it sat on somewhat of a corner and had a circle driveway. And on each end of the driveway, it was protected by a gate. On one end of the driveway sat on Rockingham Avenue, and the other end of the driveway sat on Ashford Street. The white Ford Bronco was parked near the Rockingham gate, and the limo driver from earlier that night was trying to buzz from the Ashford Street gate. So, like, they're obviously at two separate entrances. So as that limo driver is buzzing, he probably didn't see the white Bronco park at that odd angle, but saw the figure of a black man mm-hmm. walking towards the house. So you can just kind of put the puzzle pieces together for yourself. But while one officer attempted to ring the buzzer to the gate, another officer inspected the Bronco and found apparent blood stains on the driver's side door. Unable to get anyone to answer the gate, officers then climbed the fence and approached the house. OJ wasn't there, obviously, but Cato Kalin answered the door and told him he didn't know where OJ was, but that his daughter Arnell might know, and that she was in the guest room / guest house beside his. So also important to note is that bloodstains were found leading up from the Bronco's parked location to the front porch, where the limo driver said he saw a shadowy figure around 11 p.m. that night. So while police are talking to Cato in those early morning hours, Cato told them that right around 10:40 or 10:45 the night before, he was on the phone with a girlfriend and heard loud thumps on the rear wall of his room. So they walked together outside to where he said he heard the thumps, and they found a brown leather glove sticky with blood, and it belonged to a right hand.
No way.
Meanwhile, detectives finally got a hold of OJ, who at this point was now in Chicago. They told him that his ex-wife had been found dead and he needed to get back to L.A. He feigned shock and horror, saying, "Oh my God, Nicole is killed. Oh my God, she is dead." He caught the first flight back to L.A., and by the time he arrived, his house was already cordoned off as a crime scene. Police were instructed that if or when O.J. arrived at the house, he would need to be detained for questioning. And sure enough, O.J. showed up and was met by his defense attorney, Howard Weitzman, and his longtime friend, Robert Kardashian. As police placed OJ in handcuffs, they noticed that the middle finger on his left hand was wrapped in a Band-Aid. He was questioned, but police had to release him until they had more solid evidence. So OJ was sequestered to his home. 4 days after their brutal murders, Nicole and Ron were laid to rest in separate ceremonies. That same day, Thursday, June 16th, prosecutors received the results of the forensics test that were taken on the blood found at the murder scene, and it matched O.J. Simpson's. Also, blood found on the glove outside Cato's bedroom matched both Ron and Nicole's. So the next day, June 17th, a warrant was issued for the arrest of O.J. Simpson on two counts of first-degree murder with special circumstances, meaning O.J. was facing the death penalty if he was convicted. He hired Robert Shapiro to be his attorney. OJ was ordered to surrender by 11 a.m., but he never showed up to the police station. The police moved their surrender time back to noon to allow OJ to be seen by a psychiatrist because he'd been expressing thoughts of suicidal depression. He updated his will, he wrote letters to his kids and his mom, and one to the public. When he still didn't show up to the police station by noon, police told his attorney, Robert Shapiro, and friend, Robert Kardashian, that OJ would be arrested at Robert Kardashian's home. So police went to the Kardashian's house, but OJ wasn't there, and neither was his former teammate and close friend, AC Cowlings. And this person, AC, had constantly been attached at OJ's side through the funeral and the days after Nicole's death. And it didn't take long for people to start noticing that infamous white Ford Bronco with AC behind the wheel. And soon police started following the vehicle. AC called 911 to tell them that OJ was in the back seat with a gun to his head, begging police to just back off. Bystanders lined the street with signs like "Save the Juice" and "We Love the Juice." The low-speed chase was broadcast on live multiple television channels, ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, all the local channels interrupted regularly scheduled programming to cover this chase, and over 95 million viewers tuned in, which was more than that year's Super Bowl viewership. At 5 p.m., a very nervous Robert Kardashian read live on TV the note that OJ left for the public, and it says, quote, "To whom it may concern, first, everyone understand I have nothing to do with Nicole's murder. I loved her, always have, and always will. If we had a problem, it's because I loved her so much. Recently, we came to the understanding that for now we were not right for each other, at least for now. Despite our love, we were different, and that's why we mutually agreed to go our separate ways. It was tough splitting for a second time, but we both knew it was for the best. Inside, I had no doubt that in the future we would be close as friends or more. Unlike what has been written in the press, Nicole and I had a great relationship for most of our lives together. Like all long-term relationships, we had a few downs and ups. I took the heat New Year's night of 1989 because that's what I was supposed to do. I did not plead no contest for any other reason but to protect our privacy and was advised it would end the press hype. I don't want to belabor knocking the press, but I can't believe what is being said. Most of it is totally made up. I know you have a job to do, but as a last wish, please, please, please leave my children in peace. Their lives will be tough enough. I want to send my love to, and thanks to all my friends. I'm sorry I can't name every one of you, especially AC Man. Thanks for being in my life. The support and friendship I received from so many, Wayne Hughes, Lewis Marks, Frank Olson, Mark Packer, Bender, Bobby Kardashian. I wish we had spent more time together in recent years. My golfing buddies, Haas, Alan Austin, Mike, Craig, Bender, Weiler, Sandy, Jay, Donnie, thanks for the fun. All my teammates over the years, Reggie, you were the soul of my pro career. Ahmad, I never stopped being proud of you. Marcus, you're a great lady, and Catherine, don't mess it up. Bobby Chandler, thanks for always being there. Skip and Kathy, I love you guys. Without you, I would never have made it this far. Marguerite, thanks for the early years. We had some fun. Paula, what can I say? You are special. I'm sorry we're not going to have our chance. God brought you to me, I now see. As I leave, you'll be in my thoughts. I think of my life and feel I've done the most of the right things. What the outcome people will look at and point, I can't take that. And I can't subject my children to that. Sorry, it's written kind of choppy, so it's hard to read. This way, they can move on and go on with their lives. Please, if I've done anything worthwhile in my life, let my kids live in peace from you. I've had a good life. I'm proud of how I lived. My mama taught me to do unto others. I treated people the way I wanted to be treated. I've always tried to be up and helpful, so why is this happening? I'm sorry for the Goldman family. I know how much it hurts. Nicole and I had a good life together. All this press talk about a rocky relationship was no more than that, what every long-term relationship experiences. All her friends will confirm that I have been totally loving and understanding of what she's been going through. At times, I have felt like a battered husband or boyfriend, but I loved her. Make that clear to everyone. And I would take whatever it took to make it work. Don't feel sorry for me. I've had a great life, great friends. Please think of the real OJ and not this lost person. Thanks for making my life special. I hope I helped yours. Peace and love. OJ with a smiley face inside of the O. Oh, man. There's so much I could say about that letter. Like the fact that he does such a disservice to Nicole's memory and he's like shouting out his girlfriend despite having other girlfriends and doesn't say a single kind thing about Nicole.
He felt like a battered husband.
Like, you've got to be effing kidding
Thinks
me.
Thinks he did all the right he could, living right.
Why is this happening to me? Like, just there's so much. There, I could literally just pick it all apart. But finally, after traveling for about 60 miles, AC and OJ arrived back at OJ's property at about 8 p.m., but he didn't get out of the car for almost another hour. Since they knew OJ had a gun, a SWAT team was there prepared for anything that might happen. And as OJ was handcuffed, he just kept repeating that he was sorry. Police found, quote, $8,000 in cash, a change of clothing, a loaded .357 Magnum, a U.S. passport, family pictures, and a disguise kit with a fake goatee and mustache.
Whoa.
OJ was arrested, and so was AC for harboring a fugitive, and his bail was set at $250,000. I think it's interesting that they were just tiptoeing around this individual when if it was anyone else, they would have probably shot him before they ever got to this point, right? Like the fact that they gave this guy basically leeway to just be arrested on his own terms is just kind of maddening. Now, we're going to stop here, and in part two, we're going to get into the trial of the people of the state of California versus Orenthal James Simpson and what went wrong.
Mama, mystery out.
Bye.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever find yourself playing the budgeting game? Well, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive, you can find options that fit your budget and potentially lower your bills. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Not available in all states.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.